Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to New Books in Finance. I'm your host, Daniel Paris. New Books in Finance is a channel of the New Books Network, and I'm delighted today to have as my guest, Gene Ludwig, the author of The Vanishing American Dream, a frank look at the economic realities facing middle and lower income Americans. The book is just out from Disruption Books. Gene is a former banker, regulator, and serial entrepreneur. He's currently the CEO of Promontory Financial Group that advises financial institutions on compliance and security matters. Gene, thank you so much for being on the show.
Daniel, it's great to be here with you.
So your title says it all, and it has, I'm sorry to say, a rather bleak cover, dust cover, showing a picture of, I'm presuming it's going to be York, but it could be any town in that situation, that vanishing American dream. Can you describe what led you to want to address this issue of the weakening over the last several decades of the middle class, the geographic and implications for it, and the broader social problems that you're trying to address in this book?
Daniel, you got it spot on. It is indeed York, Pennsylvania, but it also it could be a picture of really thousands of smaller American cities in the United States and many bigger cities. I was moved to write this when I realized that the town that I grew up in, which was kind of Norman Rockwell America, wasn't perfect. There were, was the discriminatory aspects to the environment, not just race, but other discriminatory things weren't pretty. But fundamentally, it was a good place that had good jobs and local industries that people could be proud of, that it existed for decades and decades. York Dental Supply, York Barbell, the first air conditioner in the world, York Air Conditioner, which was famous at the time. When I went back to speak, about a decade ago, a little less than that, I realized that the town that I knew had deteriorated badly, and one can see that lamentably all over the United States. The people I love, the people I grew up with are hurting, and that's true in too much of a uniform fashion in the United States today.
And so you brought together a group of specialists, mostly on the academic side, but also kind of business and public policy people at a conference held at Yale Law School, I believe it's April of 2019. And it makes for, I'm sorry to say, very important, but rather grim reading. It's not just York, PA, as you suggest. It's a lot of middle America. I hesitate to use the term middle America. I don't know what that means, but we understand what it means. Smaller, former industrial cities, wherever they may be, and just the gutting of the middle class. And I want to launch into a discussion with what appears to be an important mismatch that you identify and most other people identify in the book, is that the aggregate numbers for the economy in this country over the past 20, 30 years are not that bad, particularly when you use what we all know to be a highly, highly flawed measure of GDP. But that the aggregate measures are hiding kind of a hollowing out and a very kind of disturbing imbalance in that level of economic activity. So again, if you were looking externally at the U.S., you'd say, well, it's not so bad. But if you look closer, the details are horrific. Can you go into, you know, that divergence between the aggregate numbers and what you see are the real shortcomings of the economy right now?
Yeah, Daniel, you've got it spot on. The numbers are horrific. After my experience of going back to York and seeing the town so deteriorated from what it was, I hired a research economist, a youngster, to start researching the national numbers, the local numbers, et cetera. And the more we dug into the numbers, the more the numbers painted a grim, as you say, but just neon bright picture. If you take, for example, just numbers in the wealth area, by the way, in particular for African Americans, for people of color, you find that for every dollar that a white family has, a black family has 10 cents. And by the way, 10 cents is a conservative, rather generous number in terms of what reality is all about. For just, you know, average Americans that are not people of color, you find that the prices of the things that they most care about to get their kids the American dream, education, is up dramatically from what it was years ago, far exceeding any increase in wages that they've experienced. I give you an example. From 2000 to 2019, while arguably median, now this isn't lower income people, this is median income, arguably gone up about 64%. Educational costs are up 119-ish%. And, you know, I may be off 1%, 2%, people may argue, but directionally, I'm spot on.
Your colleagues and contributors really circle back more than maybe I would have expected to this issue of wages and labor and wages, where in that metric, the middle class has really fallen behind, not only in terms of their earning power, but the buying power, as you just say. It's really more than this part of the national narrative about, yeah, we know the middle class is weaker than it was. There's been a hollowing out. But that wages part is, the numbers there were striking even to me, and I follow this stuff.
Yeah, no, it's kind of hidden. If you don't dig it up, if you're not following it every day, you know, it wouldn't seem obvious to you, because, you know, the national organizations like the Fed report the CPI, which is a broader basket of goods and services. And, you know, that's gone up, but it doesn't look so horrific. But if you're trying to get the very goods and services you need, health care, as I mentioned, education, rental costs, they're way up, and you are seeing your life decline.
Let's shift to causes. And here again, if you listen to CNBC or read the Wall Street Journal, read a lightly, you know, the Atlantic or Forbes or something like that, you'll come up with the usual suspects that we have for causes: globalization, technology, trade, all of which your team identifies, though it's in very significant detail. But again, back to the labor force, you refer to it as an epic mismatch between what the world needs now in terms of skills and what our society is producing in terms of skill sets, you know, middle skills, I think you call them. And that again is a striking point. Again, I don't know that you differ significantly from the standard causes that globalization and deflation, technology, et cetera. But this workforce mismatch comes back and many times as being kind of a central issue as to why the middle class has fallen behind. At least that seems to me. Is that a fair summary?
Daniel, it is. It's a multi-headed monster. And it would be nice to give you one soundbite that covered all the sins. But fundamentally, I believe the core of this has been that we thought we were doing the right thing, again, based policymakers making judgments on the basis of flawed data, Thought we're doing the right thing and saying, well, it doesn't matter if we globalize because the jobs that are going abroad are menial jobs that will be replaced in the United States by great jobs that are, higher value jobs, and there will be a higher wage. But unfortunately, the U.S. labor force is not educated for those higher skilled jobs, whether it's in machine and tool work. The Germans have been excellent at that. So that's not a college job, but it is a highly skilled job, equivalently skilled and needed. It's true in the whole technology area of computer programming and computer developments. It's been a disaster in terms of our own educational system. And if you look at the comparing the American educational system, even at the secondary level, compared to what it is in other countries around the world, we're not just not number one. We're way down the pecking order. Of course, when you're way down the pecking order, that doesn't mean that people who can afford to go to the fancy schools and secondary schools and colleges and universities can't get an excellent education here. But it does mean that if you don't have access to those resources, you're in the middle and lower income groups. Again, you're the ones who most slide off the edge of the table.
So, but let's push back a little bit, because the educational shortcomings, the mismatch, there really is some truth to the standard narrative about globalization and free trade. Is there not? Again, I'm not taking sides. I'm just echoing the fact that over the past 10, 15 years, this has become part of the narrative that what was identified in the 80s and 90s or even earlier as a positive, as you correctly say, is now probably correctly identified, for better or for worse, with deflationary trends and the hollowing out of the middle class. And so there has to be some acknowledgement that those macro issues, I think that those macro issues also play a role. It's not just that we don't have vocational training the way the Germans do. There's, as you say, it's a multi-headed monster, but national policy issues play a role.
Absolutely. There is no doubt that this is a complex matter where there are, as I say, a lot of heads to this monster. And the way we've gone about globalization, assuming that in a classical economic sense, the more trade you have, the better off net-net things are going to be, has just been wrong. Net-net, it's going to be maybe on a global basis, but not necessarily where you are if you're not going to keep ahead on education and other talents. So that's number one. And number two, we've allowed ourselves into some trade deals that have been lopsided, and furthermore, where in some cases our trading partners have not at all been scrupulous about their obligations. They've cheated. And so that hurts too. So, and technology, there's no doubt that technology takes some jobs away. And in certain areas, there are going to be less jobs to do for the goods produced. But we have so much need in this country for good jobs, whether it's in the service area, healthcare, whether it's in the educational area, teaching, whether it's in construction area. We have an infrastructure in this country that is deteriorating by the hour.
Okay, so we're in agreement there that the causes are what they are, and there are many of them. Let's shift to really what the point of your gathering was at Yale. And again, I should highlight that this was a gathering of illustrious people at the Yale Law School, a combination of academics, business people, policy people. And your point in bringing them together was not just to bring them together, but to come up with some hopefully practical solutions. Do you want to sort of introduce, not everyone because it's a long list, but your idea of this brain trust and trying to get as many smart ideas out of as many smart people as you could?
Certainly. First, I wanted it to be bipartisan. In other words, conservative economists and liberal economists. business people and activists, academics and practical people who are on the ground, like mayors, governors, notable public servants who've had big national roles, who've seen the country from a big national purview, as well as people who see it absolutely on the ground day to day. So as wide a spectrum of well-known people as you could, Nobel Prize winner, Secretary of the Treasury, Governor of Massachusetts, Mayor of Hartford, famous economist slash editor, as broad a spectrum of people as we could, because although I had a belief that the economy for middle and low income Americans was sliding, and some belief as to what the causes were, I didn't go into this with the notion that I was necessarily right, or that some of the policy prescriptions I would have thought our directions to go in were right at all. So we asked three questions fundamentally. It's three and a half. One, is it that bad and why? Two, what do you do about it on a national basis? What are the national policies you should follow if you want to turn this around? And then three, what are the local policies? Because the national policy, the local policies are not always exactly the same. I'll give you an example of that. If you're a mayor in Hartford or New Haven, and a national policy is, by God, we're going to come into Hartford and New Haven, and we're going to educate these kids so they are the best at everything in the world. What's going to happen today, because there are no jobs in Hartford, New Haven to speak of, is they're going to all leave. And so you haven't made Hartford and New Haven particularly better. So we brought this illustrious gathering together, not just as a way to have fancy names, but to have as many diverse points of view as we could. And I, if I hadn't mentioned, I just want to emphasize, we brought business people together, people who have run businesses, who would have an important role, a critical role, because after all, where do jobs come from? Where does opportunity come from? In the United States, comes heavily from the business community.
So let's get to those solutions. And again, acknowledging, I like how the book is organized and how you just introduced it, because I think it's very important. I think most people, once they think about it, come to realize this distinction between national solutions, the federal government level, national policies versus local solutions. You can feel that if you're in New York, certain government policies from DC will matter, others less so. Certain local policies will matter more so. So you do separate the panels into national solutions and then a follow-up panel on local solutions. And then it begins to sound like the Sunday morning talk show on the national solutions. And if that sounds, I apologize if that sounds a little snarky, but there is an element to that where you have these individuals talking, as we have spoken about for decades, about this is what we should be doing, this is what we should be doing, this is what we should be doing. And that's why I like the local element of it coming in afterwards, because that seemed in many ways more practical. But at the national level, there seemed to be a consensus, despite the reasonably broad political views, that there were a couple key points that you wanted to make or the group made in terms of national policy initiatives. I have them noted down as educational and training, infrastructure, and fixing the labor market. But you may want to present them in a different order. But let's take them. You've already referenced it, but let's be very specific about it. Educational and training addresses what appears to be almost I wouldn't call it the underlying main cause of the problem. It comes up over and over again that we just don't have, that we have that epic mismatch. And you highlight community colleges. Do you want to, or several of your speakers highlighted community colleges. Do you want to explain why they make so much sense in this environment?
Community colleges are, in America, very much career focused. And a number of our speakers brought that out, that their career training operations. Oh, they can lead to four-year college and even graduate school. But very much community colleges have been about, basic college education tied with skills training for a practical job, whether it's nursing or your physical therapy, still in the healthcare area, but also, again, whether it's
computer science or welding, whatever the case may be.
Exactly. And so that's one of the reasons people felt so strongly that that was something that ought to be made available, including you know, right and left were of the view that these community colleges should be free or nearly free.
I wonder if we don't have, this is a heretical statement, I wonder if we don't have too many liberal arts colleges. Who's to say? Well, I don't know.
Well, it depends what you do there, I think, in part. And I don't think it means that they have to be narrowly career focused, but I do think that we need much higher standards, and we need to emphasize a level of work ethic that is not necessarily uniform in the United States, that these aren't places to have fun. These are places to work and learn. Now, with that, being there's a decline in the number of them, possibly. I guess I'm a little bit biased, Daniel. I believe you can't have too much education. And if to some degree, some of the time is in a sense wasted on liberal arts, if it's serious, so much the better. Then you can go off and do other things. We've just got to put massively more emphasis and money into the entire educational construct.
On that, we can agree. It's just a matter, you know, you referenced the German system earlier, and I agree with you there, where there's a linguistic difference or semantic difference between universities, which tend to offer the liberal arts, and the vocational institutions, which focus more on training. We have this whole notion of everything's a university, everything's a college, but I think it serves people better to clarify the difference between vocational training and liberal arts training. But that's more a topic for another day. In addition to the educational and training, you kind of a traditional answer of infrastructure investment. Larry Summers had some interesting comments about, you know, when you do that and how you pay for it. But there was general agreement on infrastructure. As a person who's participated in the financial system in finance for the last two decades and compare the, you know, financial Federal Reserve or quantitative easing strategies as opposed to building bridges, it's clear one of those works better than the other, and it's building bridges. And, you know, infrastructure really does matter.
Well, yes. And look, the infrastructure, if you'll excuse the expression, can be a bridge to nowhere if we don't make other changes. But it's so important for two reasons. One, it's a way to get people to work in meaningfully paid jobs relatively quickly. It's not immediate. I don't know anything that's immediate. So it's 18 months or 24 months or 12 months. There's a lot of arguments about it, but it will get people. When you build bridges, you know, you have product, you have to produce, you need physical labor, and it's well paid. We probably got in this country at least a decade of effort there. Now, if you say, well, where's the money coming from? What I find astounding is that we've just spent $2 trillion, actually more like three, do the PPP program and another $1 trillion on tax relief. I'm not saying these aren't needed. On the contrary, the PPP was very much needed. But what I am saying is we can find the money when we need it. Right? Just as they've analogized the need for PPP to a World War II need, I would analogize the need to get the middle and lower income part of Americans going again and giving them a fair wage and opportunity as a World War II kind of need. And we can sure find the money, and we've got to spend it and do it.
It's something that Robert Shiller makes from a slightly different context about community and binding together, but he makes the same World War II point a number of times in the book.
Very well said. Absolutely.
In addition to infrastructure and education and training, the national solution at the level of national solutions, the fixing the labor market returns again and again. It's sort of, as I said, a kind of a thread that holds the whole book together is the broken labor market. What at the national level are the solutions or proposed solutions to fix that part of the problem?
Well, the one thing I think that is probably you'd find unusual given the diversity of the participants is the agreement that we've got to do something to enliven the private sector, private industry. At the end of the day, let's face it, government can produce many jobs, but most jobs in this country are produced by the private sector. And it is very much a good jobs question with good wages. So why have we seen in places like York, Pennsylvania, globally leading important industries either decline or get sold out and disappear with all that comes with that? Both from a civic support sense to a working man and woman on the ground sense, and what can we do to reverse that? That has to be reversed, or we will never solve the problem. Well, there are a number of pieces to it, but one piece that I care about personally, and I've been involved in this as a regulator, is regulation. Regulation's needed. We have to protect our people. We have to do it in healthcare and finance and lots of areas. But it has to be smart regulation. It can't be a constant building up of regulations that are so complex that you can't have small businesses operate, that you fundamentally drag down the efficiencies of business and therefore drag down the economy. Now, how you do that there, if you say it, what I've been covering today is not a soundbite, there you've really got no soundbite, because this has got to be something that is a national priority, but it has got to be something where you get the best and the brightest to do these things with scalpels, not meat axes.
And the opportunity to do so appears to be less and less right now because there is no national consensus on these solutions. There is no, to echo Bob Shiller, there's no World War II to rally around for this. Everyone agrees there's a major problem, but the disagreements are as great as the only thing that's agreed upon is the nature of the problem, is the problem, maybe even not the nature of it. Certainly, no one's agreeing on the solutions at this point in our circa 2020, despite your effort to gather a broad group of people from a legislative perspective. The prospect of getting something done anytime soon, I'm sorry to say, seems to be quite low.
Yes and no, Daniel. This, from a regulatory perspective, oddly enough, the big headline concerns that tie up the Congress in knots are really not mostly where the rubber meets the road. The rubber meets the road in regulation, and that is something that federal and state and local agencies can deal with. So that if you have an administration that really focuses on this in a mature, careful way, as I believe we did, not perfectly by any stretch of the imagination, but to a great degree during the Clinton administration, we can make great progress. It's not, again, soundbite stuff, but a great deal can be done. If there was a soundbite to tell you, the one thing I would focus on at every agency is having really effective ombudsman programs that can hear the complaints of individuals who have been wronged and businesses that have been tied into knots. We did that when I was in government. We had the first one at the Comptroller's Office in the financial services area. Congress ultimately mandated puts people at all the other agencies, that is banking agencies. The problem is there has not been, since the Clinton administration, a will to make these offices effective. But this is something that would be a significant plus in terms of getting one's handle on the regulations.
Well, I hope that's indeed the case, the sort of behind-the-scenes regulation. That provides a nice segue to what is very interesting part of the book, most interesting part of the book, which is local solutions. And you started with York, PA, and then you have a lot of local mayors and governors speaking. And sometimes local is right. It's just easier. You can't solve the world's problems. You solve a problem one at a time, and that occurs on a local spectrum. I thought that that was in some ways more encouraging. More, the description of local circumstances was very distressing, but also the energy and enthusiasm towards local solutions was very high, in many ways higher than for national solutions. And so I took some encouragement from that, however hard it is, that you can't fix the whole country, you fix one community at a time. Albeit you mentioned, you know, there's a fluid labor market, and if you fix one area, the labor force will move. But nevertheless, can you highlight some of the local solutions that you're participants brought to the fore?
Sure. But most cities and towns in America, maybe all of them, have something special that often caused them to grow up and at one time in history be successful. Whether it's a and often they leave behind those periods of success also platforms that can be used for future development. Let me give you some examples. In New York, Pennsylvania, there's a beautiful historic old town. If that old town were really focused on with more vigor than it is, it could result in a kind of Williamsburg environment that would attract tourism, would attract businesses to locate in New York because of its beauty and how felicitous it is to live in that area. Other towns have they're at a crossroads of major geographic areas, and they have a natural place for distribution, right? Even in our day and age today, when we're on the internet, the goods have to be distributed from somewhere. And some of these places are natural hubs for distribution. Other cities and towns have the natural opportunity for energy generation with many of the new energy technologies that we have, either because of constant wind or sun or even hydroelectric. Any town can be sufficiently enlightened to place local emphasis on its own training and educational opportunities and its own tax environment or other changes to the environment that can make them more felicitous in terms of inviting businesses to grow and prosper in their locations. There's lots local mayors and town councils can do to make their local units attractive in advance.
I've shifted. One story amounts to nothing, but over the years, I've shifted sort of my charitable donations to. I've just come to the conclusion that I feel it locally and it makes more sense and I can see the benefits of it. And I've shifted from sort of national organizations to local organizations. I just think there's a psychological element to that that has some import, frankly, compared to, boy, I hope Washington can figure this out, because that's a difficult proposition regardless of administration and so forth. And I know you served in a national administration. And all the respect to that, but I think there is a local bias that many people have that they figure they can solve things in their local community more readily than they can in the nation.
Well, one good example of that, Daniel, is I believe you said that you had moved from Philly to Pittsburgh and your now home is Pittsburgh. But Pittsburgh has the Growing Up Great program, which PNC Bank, particularly the former chairman, Jim Rohr, got going. And it's a terrific preschool to focus on giving kids an extra boost, particularly in low-income communities. And that's an example of a local focus, local program in the educational area that's made a big difference in the Pittsburgh community.
Yeah, I'm involved with two. I'm not involved with that one, but I'm involved with two others that are address similar issues. And again, I don't know. We'll know in 100 years, but it certainly feels like the right thing to do right here, right now. Let me shift to maybe problems with the solution. You acknowledge in your conclusion, sort of a call to arms, but you acknowledge, listen, this is hard. There is no one solution. It requires things we don't currently have. But I want to kind of synthesize those challenges and summarize them and push back a little bit just for the sake of argument. First of all, you gathered some very smart people, but then one person opens his mouth and turns out he's the agent provocateur. Shouldn't be too hard to figure out who he is. And he sets everyone back on their heels. We have a bunch of very, very smart people gathered at Yale, at the Yale Law School. And one of the people stands up and says, you know, we're all part of the problem, not part of the solution. And it's a striking moment. Do you want to, you know, describe that and why he's awfully correct in some regard?
Well, there is no doubt that the fundamental point that he made most, upfront or noisily or whatever, was a point that others had made as well, that private schools, including Yale and Harvard and Princeton, are places of privilege. They're expensive to get into. They are highly selective, and they're not in and of themselves, you know, easily accessible by low and moderate income Americans. In other words, you just can't, you can get scholarships and ways to get there, but it's not as, part of the sort of solution as state schools have been historically in America. And that's a real issue. There's no doubt about that. They have been places of privilege as well as places of great education. America is a rich and diverse society. And I think that is what's most needed is not to worry about that, but to worry about the affordability and the quality of what used to be state universities, the California system, Penn State and our state of Pennsylvania, that not only could provide superb education, but also were economically accessible to everybody. But when I was the youngster, I believe the number is correct, but it's certainly directionally correct, that it cost $400 a semester to go to Penn State. Even in those days, virtually everybody could afford $400 a semester. Again, this is directionally correct, though the number may not be perfectly accurate, but I think it's $18,000 today. And then you got room and board, books, and this and that. So no matter what you do in terms of looking at wage growth during that period, it doesn't nearly keep up with the increase in the cost of going to places like Penn State. And as you know, these state schools in America have also struggled in terms of their own economics and the grants they've been able to get from the state governments. That's a much bigger issue for us, in my view, than the relatively small in number and, you know, size of educational impact in terms of numbers of people that schools like Yale, Harvard, and Princeton or whatever count for.
So I had the benefit of going both to a small liberal arts college in the Northeast and also a Big Ten land-grant university. And as pleasant and rewarding as the former was, it's very, very clear that the bang for the buck for society was so much more on the side of the land-grant university. It wasn't even a comparison. And the nameplate of my liberal arts college was great and has served me well. But the educational bang for the buck of a Big Ten school is sort of unbeatable. So
I'm totally
sort of in agreement there.
Totally with you. And furthermore, I went to a public high school. Maybe you did as well, but I went to a public high school. I got an excellent education. And I also got an education in a diverse community of people that has served me well in life, people who did all kinds of different things in life and had different upbringings. So there's a lot of advantages not to being in a narrow, privileged environment that really serves you well in terms of your own success.
Abington High School, class of 1982, go galloping ghosts. So the agent provocateur was Larry Summers, by the way, former Treasury Secretary, former president of Harvard. I do want to circle back to his point. He made an observation, not just that we're part of the problem, not part of the solution, but he said that the policy prescriptions coming out of a Yale Law School seminar are going to be largely rejected by some portion of the population that just doesn't want to hear from policy prescriptions from the Yale Law School because of it's coming from, et cetera. So there is underlying social tensions that make this harder when, you know, the people in whose name I'm going to be paraphrasing him or someone who's commenting on him, but, you know, in whose name you're trying to people who you're trying to benefit or act on behalf of them really aren't that interested in your help or don't share your worldview to begin with. That makes this even harder. And I think that's a fundamental challenge to what you're trying to do in the current society where, boy, are we divided.
Well said. There is no doubt there is a great deal of anger and mistrust where there are a number of Americans that believe that the programs, however well-intended, that were meant to be helpful have not been helpful to them. And you hit upon free trade, which has certainly been a flashpoint in that regard. And then, of course, we in America have a natural and in my case, highly respected, a pioneer spirit where people like to do things on their own. And they really want to be able to use their own energy and their own lights to be able to advance and don't like to think that they're just getting handouts. That's very respectable. But I'm afraid that it doesn't mean that one doesn't have to create the national and local petri dish where they actually have a chance to use those skills in a productive way that will allow them to be independent and advance their justifiable economic upwardly mobile desires. Unfortunately, we don't have that petri dish environment in the United States at the moment in too many cases. And however much people rail at the system, railing in and of itself will not solve the problem.
And this is where I was struck a little bit again by Bob Shiller's comments, which were a little bit out of the ordinary for him. He's a very talented historian. A lot of his work is historical finance. And I follow him in other venues. But his point that, you know, World War II provided cohesion, which allowed a lot of national policies and even local policies to work better. And in the, it's been a long time since we have been that unified in a goal. And I had to kind of agree that's striking, but it's almost a sad commentary that you would need a war in order to rally people. That's a at once true and frightening.
Well, that point, which is an excellent point, and Bob Shiller is an enormously talented human being, was taken up in a slightly different way by Jacob Hacker. Hacker's written a number of superb books, one of which called Amnesia. The point of calling it Amnesia is that we've sort of, you know, gotten amnesia as to what was a very good period of time from 1945 through the 1970s, where business, labor, and government had a loosely speaking kind of social compact for advancing the well-being of America. And it wasn't always the case that everybody was at each other's throats. And of course, he longs for going back to that period. In that regard, there is, I think, there are some very good signs that kind of period of a more cohesive society is something that people are striving for. The Business Roundtable, as you probably know, Daniel, has adopted a stakeholder value focus goal as distinct from only shareholder value. And that's a big deal, actually. I don't think it's gotten enough attention because in doing that, what the Roundtable is saying is that there are a variety of stakeholders in business that are of equivalent importance, including workers, not just shareholders, so that it shouldn't be just about shareholder excess, but it should be about a shared set of stakeholder responsibilities and opportunities, which I think is really quite exciting and respectable.
I hope you're correct on that. I will tell you, as a person who operates in the investment management industry, if I were to pursue stakeholder capitalism as of today, the SEC would be calling tomorrow because the rules, the go to jail rules, the the you know 40 Act rules and the various investment rules are still all about shareholder activity. And if you shift and get ahead of the laws and adopt a stakeholder approach, you actually run legal risks. So it's just something that it's nice for the Business Roundtable to do it. Someone like me in the industry, kind of buried in the depths of the investment industry, will take our cues as much from the SEC as we will from the Business Roundtable. Well, so just a note there.
Yeah, more so. You're absolutely right. But directionally, it's important. It doesn't mean that there aren't lots of other things that need to be done to catch up.
Fair enough. I want to wrap up, if I can, with where you started, Gene, and sort of challenge. You do highlight in your introduction sort of the negative outcome. And there's sort of this book was largely written before COVID. The conference occurred over a year ago, and the book was finished up in COVID. But you do reference the Spanish Empire. I could almost refer to it as the Spanish flu from 100 years ago. But you reference the Spanish Empire based on the silver mines and silver mountains of South America. They took all that money and they didn't do much with it. And then when the silver ran out, so did the Spanish Empire. And it falls into a context, I'm as a historian very sensitive to these things, that empires come and go, hegemons come and go, dynasties come and go, kingdoms come and go, dominant societies, even liberal ones. There isn't much of a track record because liberalism, classical liberalism in the sense of the type that we've been pursuing for the last couple hundred years is relatively young in the broad scope of world history. But dominant societies, shall we say, whether they're liberal or illiberal, come and go. And, you know, it's you read the news and you might come to the conclusion that the United States is in the eighth or ninth inning, and that what you're describing as the situation in York, PA, and in many other communities is unavoidable. And I know you don't take that view, but it's possible to take that view. And I wish you would kind of end on why I'm wrong about viewing this as sort of a natural decline of a dominant society, as all the other dominant societies for the last 5,000 years have fallen prey to.
That's an excellent, excellent point and admonition that this is hard, and what we're focusing on and in the book, which is turning around the trajectory of the United States, is important, but very, very hard. I guess I would turn our attention to China. China's, if not the oldest, certainly one of the oldest civilizations and national groupings that we know about. And it's gone through some pretty difficult times. At the same time, we're seeing the rise of China really astounding in terms of the speed and the social cohesion that we're seeing. By God, we all know that China isn't perfect, and we certainly don't want to turn the United States into China. But it is an example of a very old society that has been through ebbs and flows for literally thousands of years in that case. There's no reason to think with the wealth of the United States and what should be the very good and historically good relationship with our neighbor to the north, and most often with our neighbor to the south. So we control an immense continent, immense and wealthy continent, that the United States, doesn't have a few more hundred, if not thousand years left in it.
I absolutely hope that's the case. Can I ask you, the conference, the book, what's next? This is a book, not just a reflection on society. This is a call for action. How are you following up with this to try to make some of these policy prescriptions take effect?
Well, the first thing we're going to do and are doing right now, so stay tuned, is we're coming out with a LICEP website. That LICEP is the Institute for Shared Economic Prosperity. And the website will have what I think people will mostly view as astonishing data in terms of sort of what are the real numbers that, meaningful numbers in terms of unemployment rates, GDP, and ultimately the inflation. as starters. So the policy people in the United States, right, left, center, whatever, can focus on the real numbers. That, I think, will make a very significant contribution.
I hope you will come up with a replacement for GDP. That would be very helpful for all of us.
It is on the drawing board. Yes, we will. And we are planning, already in the planning phases, for a second seminar, a second book that will focus on exactly the areas that you have cared about, which is, okay, how do you really implement these things? How do you really turn things around and get them going? And so stay tuned.
I look forward to having you back on the show to discuss the implementation stage. The book is The Vanishing American Dream, a frank look at the economic realities facing middle and lower income Americans, edited by Gene Ludwig. Gene, thank you so much for being a guest on the show.
Daniel, honored to be with you. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.